Leo Durocher is famously said to have said, "Nice guys finish last." Now, he also might plausibly, rhetorically have asked, "Who says cheaters never prosper?" It is not known that he ever said such in relation to a grand scheme that may have had a decisive bearing.
The microphone is a lousy microphone. You've got to put it right
here. It is not known. Got it. It is not known that he ever said that. That who says cheaters ever prosper? In relation to a grand strategy that may have had a decisive bearing on the greatest comeback in pennant race history. But ever the gamesman, if Leo didn't, he probably should have, just to mess with our heads. I speak, of course, of the revelation, nearly half a century after the fact, by Joshua Prager, first in the Wall Street Journal article and then in his book, The Echoing Green, that Durocher installed a coach, Herman Franks, in the Giants clubhouse at the Polo Grounds, way beyond center field, to steal opposing catcher's signs looking through a powerful telescope, to then relay those signs through an electrical buzzer system to the Giants bullpen out in right field, from where they would be flashed to New York Giants hitters in their turn at bat. The implication being that without that center field spy, Bobby Thompson would not have hit perhaps the most famous decisive home run in history, and that moreover, there would have been no miracle on Coogan's Bluff, whereby the Giants came from 13 and a half games out in the middle of the day of August 11th to finish the 154-game schedule, tied with Brooklyn, forcing a three-game playoff that set up Mr. Thompson's big day. Now, this has some significance in terms of how exactly should we evaluate Leo Durocher's Hall of Fame career. There are many amazing accomplishments in Leo's career. The one I would like to focus on in particular, and just to briefly mention, is the role he played in integrating Major League Baseball, where in spring training of 1947, he basically told the Southern contingent of the Brooklyn Dodgers that Jackie is a great player, he's going to help us win, he's your teammate, deal with it. And since yesterday we heard about Leave It to Beaver in one of the presentations, I'd make note of the fact that he actually appeared on the Beverly Hillbillies in the 1960s. And then, of course, he was on the other side of a miracle back in 1969, but that's a bedtime story for Missy the Met fan, for another occasion. But the bottom line is that Leo's Hall of Fame legacy is built to a very great extent on that tremendous comeback in 1951. From his Hall of Fame plaque, take away that middle pennant of the three, and you have to wonder, well, would Leo even have a plaque in Cooperstown today? But he was a great manager. That said, if ever there was a manager who would have relished also being a spy master, well, that would be Mr. Leo Durocher. See, Leo had a rap sheet. And among his more notorious activities, in 1947, he was suspended for the entire season for conduct detrimental to the best interests of baseball when his salacious celebrity tabloid fodder lifestyle finally caught up with him. And then the next year, he became a traitorous swine when one day he's managing Brooklyn, a few days later, it's up in Harlem. Of course, the fact that he was fired from the new Brooklyn Dodgers had a little something to do with that. And we're not even going to get to his episode where he played himself on the Beverly Hillbillies. Even his Hall of Fame plaque gets to the character of the man. Colorful, controversial, combative, swashbuckler. So, when seldom used reserve infielder Hank Shenz says to Leo, "When I was with the Cubs, I used to hide in the center field scoreboard at Wrigley Field and steal opposing catcher's signs. And, oh, by the way, I still happen to have a telescope." You might say that aroused Leo's interest. And it being that the New York Giants were in the midst of a homestand in which they had won only 6 of 11 games so far, and that they trailed the Dodgers at this point by 7.5 games, you might say that motivated Leo. Now, Prager writes in his book that Durocher canvassed his clubhouse to get buy-in into the scheme. And although several players said they would prefer to rely on their own visual acuity, their instincts, their skill set to hit, they didn't need no center field spy, Leo kind of carried the day. And so the very next day, July 20th, 1951, the New York Giants signals intercept operation, is what I'll call it, went into effect. But the issue, what's ironic about this, is that scoring runs wasn't really the Giants' problem. They were second in the league in scoring to Brooklyn at this point in time. And in that 11 games of the homestand so far, they had scored 69 runs. That's an average of 6.3 a game, and had knocked out 22 home runs. Scoring runs wasn't the problem they were having. Their problem was they were giving up too many runs. 63 in those 11 games so far in that homestand, and only one team in the entire National League to this point of the season had given up more runs than the Giants, and that was the last place Pirates. So their first victim was a gentleman named Ewell Blackwell. He had the very deceptive delivery known as the whip. Blackwell had already faced the Giants 18 innings over the season with an excellent ERA of 2. This day, however, he never made it out of the first inning. He got shellacked for 3 runs in the first inning, the Giants on their way to an 11-5 blowout victory over the Cincinnati Reds. So, maybe Blackwell was just having a bad day. It happens. But if Leo had any doubts about the efficacy of this spy operation, which we shall call between us Operation Sign Catcher, if he had any doubts, this may have alleviated them. Now, let me be very clear here as you look at what the operation was. If stealing the other team's signs allowed the Giants to steal just one win between July 20th and the end of the scheduled 154-game season, just one, then it had a decisive bearing on the outcome of that pennant race, because just one win less, and there would have been no miracle in Coogan's Bluff. The Giants' surge to the pennant would have come up one game short. And many of us would be asking, well, who the heck was that Bobby Thompson guy again? So it does beg the question, just how much of an advantage was the advantage of having a center field spy? Well, as it turned out, the Giants had 28 home games remaining. They won 23 of them at the Polo Grounds with Operation Sign Catcher in effect. 10 of those were by one run. They played the Dodgers 5 times at home in that period of time. They won all 5 of those games. However, more than half of the games the Giants had from now till the end of the season actually were on the road. 10 more, in fact. And so given that 38 of their remaining 66 games are going to be played in ballparks where they did not have the advantage of a center field spy, they're going to have to do very well on the road too, which they did. They won 26 of those games. But maybe the better optic is to take a look, how did they do from August 12th to the end of the season, after they reached their nadir of 13 games behind the Giants on August 11th. The Giants, behind the Dodgers, the Giants at this point were actually not playing very well. They had won only 9 of 18 games, had just come off of a 17-game road trip in which they went 9-8. The Dodgers won 3 games against them, and they celebrated their sweep at Ebbets Field by serenading the Giants from the adjoining clubhouse with Roll Out the Barrel. As it happened at this point, the Giants had more games at home than they did on the road till the end of the season. But the vagaries of the schedule were such that while 20 of the next 23 games would be at the Polo Grounds, 18 of their last 21 would be on the road. On August 12th, they began a 16-game winning streak that kept their pennant race hopes alive. 13 of them were at home. Still, on September 5th, when they began their last extended road trip of the season, their deficit to the Dodgers was still 6 games. They were 6 games behind. And they had only 3 games remaining at the Polo Grounds. So if they were going to win this thing, they were going to have to win it on the road, which is what they did, winning 14 of their 18 games in September. But Operation Sign Catcher is really about helping their hitters. Before July 20th, they averaged 5.5 runs in 46 games that they played at the Polo Grounds. substantially more than the 5.1 they averaged on the road. Afterwards, their runs per game average dropped relative to before at the Polo Grounds and was only marginally better than it had been on the road. And then after August 11th, they played substantially better, scored substantially better on the road than they did at home. But an average is just an average. This is the most important homestand the Giants played in 1951. Important because they started with 8 games behind the Dodgers, and when it would end, however it would end, they would have only 3 games left at the Polo Grounds. They won 11 of those 14 games. They scored 77 runs. That's an average of 5.5 a game. So they certainly had their hitting shoes on at this period of time. Even if having a center field spy didn't necessarily help in terms of scoring runs, perhaps it helped to facilitate home runs that could have had a decisive bearing on the outcome of ball games. After all, Thompson's blast reminds us that the long ball is baseball's most potent weapon. One hit, one run, more if runners are on base. They actually averaged more home runs before July 26th than they did after, but the entire average in the National League was down in the months of August and September by 26% compared to what it had been the first 3.5 months. And then let's take a look at that 14-game homestand. Well, they not only had their hitting shoes on, they had their power hitting shoes on. 25 home runs in those 14 games, 9 multi-home run games, 4 games with 3 or more home runs, including back-to-back games on 1st and 2nd of September against the hunted and by now increasingly haunted Brooklyn Dodgers. One might expect that having Herman Franks out in the clubhouse with a telescope might have helped to facilitate them being able to jump on the starting pitcher for runs in the first inning. The more the better, force the visiting team to play from behind. And that moreover, having that advantage would enable them to have more big innings of 3 runs or more during games. In fact, the Giants scored in the first inning of precisely half of their remaining 28 games at home. But in only 3 of those first innings did they score 3 or more runs. 3 other National League teams that you can see at the top had more big first innings in their home ballpark than did the Giants. In their remaining 28 games at home, in only 11 of them did the Giants have any big innings at all. They had 13 such innings total. 3 of them against the Brooklyn Dodgers on those 2 days. Still, as you can see from this graphic, only one team in the entire National League had fewer big innings in their home ballpark after July 20th than did the New York Giants. What about blowout wins? They won 10 games at the Polo Grounds in 1951 by margins of 5 runs or more. But 7 of them were before Operation Sign Catcher went into effect. In fact, after July 20th, despite not having the advantage of a center field spy on the road, they had twice as many blowout victories on the road as they did at home. But 2 of those 3 were against the Brooklyn Dodgers on the 1st and the 2nd of September by scores of 9-1 and 11-2. Come from behind wins. One would think that perhaps this would be a big advantage if the Giants were going to need to overcome a deficit if they were to win the game. And in fact, 10 of the Giants' 23 victories at home after July 20th came in games where they trailed at some point after the first inning. Not that unusual in league context. The Brooklyn Dodgers also had 10 come-from-behind victories at Ebbets Field. The Cubs had 12 at Wrigley. However, on that key homestand, there were 4 dramatic late-inning come-from-behind rallies, including a 6-run 8th against the Reds on the 21st of August to overcome a 4-run deficit. To whatever extent having a center field spy may have contributed to their 5 walk-off wins from July 20th till the end of the season, there were 3 other teams with exactly the same number, and the Cubs won 6 walk-offs at Wrigley Field, which the Giants, of course, matched when Thompson hit his home run. Now, none of the core regulars of the 1951 New York Giants, shown here in Leo DeRocher's typical batting order the last 2 months of the season, none of them ever admitted that Herman Franks behind the telescope had anything to do with their hitting prowess. The player most associated with having benefited from the spy operation was Bobby Thompson, As of July 20th, he was leading the Giants in home runs with 16. He was second to Monty Irvin in RBIs. But as you can see, he was kind of struggling at the plate. In fact, he had been benched earlier in the month by DeRocher after Operation Sign Catcher went into effect. And I'm not accusing here, I'm just saying what the data is showing. He went on a hitting tear. In fact, his batting average at home and away was virtually the same, and it is interesting to know that with regard to his power numbers, home runs and RBI, much better on the road than they were at home. Of course, they did play more there as well. Eddie Stanky hit for a higher average on the road at home after July 20th than he did before, and hit for a much higher average at home than he did away after July 20th. His single in the bottom of the ninth with two out on the last scheduled game of the season at the Polo Grounds, with only four games remaining, helped keep the Giants pennant drive alive. It brought the Giants to within 2.5 games of the Dodgers. They lose that game, they would have been 3 games out. There would have been no playoff to have to worry about. Whitey Lockman, according to Prager, was one of only two players, Irvin was the other, who told Leo DeRocher he really didn't want to know what pitch was coming, even from a runner on second base stealing opposing catcher's signs. After July 20th, he hit 6 home runs. All 6 of those home runs were hit at the Polo Grounds. And he also figured prominently in 3 of those 4 dramatic late inning rallies we were talking about on that key homestand. Which brings us to Don Mueller. As you can see, Mueller's batting average at home actually dropped after July 20th from what it was before. But there was something about something that really caused Don Mueller to bring out his inner babe. Let's put it that way. While Thompson's home run may have killed off the Brooklyn Dodgers, if there was ever a New York Giant who should have been considered the Dodger killer in 1951, well, that would have been Don Mueller. 6 of his 7 Polo Ground home runs after July 20th were against the Dodgers. On September 1st and 2nd, he hit 5 in consecutive games. After the first of those games, when he hit 3, according to Prager, Coach Cookie Lavaghetto tells manager Charlie Dressen, "Have you noticed whenever we come here, we never fool anybody? We throw a guy a change of pace, and he seems to know it's coming." The next day, Mueller hit 2 more home runs, tying a major league record with these 4 gentlemen, all of whom are in the Hall of Fame. Nobody is going to mistake Don Mueller as a Hall of Famer. Certainly not this guy, who never hit 5 home runs in consecutive games. Now, he did hit 5 in consecutive days in 1927, and even did one better in 1930, hitting 6 in consecutive games, but those involved doubleheaders. Wes Westrum hit a paltry 131 at home after July 20th, but he had 3 critical home runs. 1 against Ralph Branca, breaking up a 1-1 tie on August 15th, leading to a Giants victory. Then he hit that 3-run home run in that 6-run 8th against the Cincinnati Reds on the 21st of August. And then 5 days later, a walk-off against the Chicago Cubs, which led to their 13th consecutive win. Willie Mays was described by his latest biographer, James Hirsch, as being circumspect on the issue. Just up from Minneapolis, earlier from the season, Mays' stats were basically the same before and after. Monty Irvin, in my opinion, should have been the most valuable player in the National League in 1951. He was emphatic in telling Leo, "I don't need no stinking center field spy to be a dangerous hitter." As you can see, and then he went out to prove the point. He made a habit, after July 20th, of going into opposing teams' ballparks and tearing the place apart, as you can see there. Alvin Dart was the only one who, whether there was any benefit to having a center field spy or not, seemed to do worse afterwards. Now, how much of an advantage was the advantage? I think in neutral context, it is fair to say, I wouldn't argue if you wanted to say, that it's only a marginal advantage. But the context was not neutral. The Giants had to overcome a huge deficit. A marginal advantage is not irrelevant. And remember what I said before, If having Herman Franks with a telescope out beyond center field made a difference in just one game, just one, then the Polo Grounds spy operation had a decisive impact. What should we think of Leo? Well, like any manager, he would seize any advantage he could to win. But the Giants would not have won the 1951 pennant by cheating alone. They wound up, by the way, giving up the fewest runs in the National League. But it does beg the question, did anyone ever think to ask, where's Herman Franks? Anyway, there's no cheating in baseball. Just ask Leo. He'll tell you himself. Thank you.
Do we have any questions for Brian? We got one more left.
How Franks communicated to the
bullpen? It was an electrical buzzer system that an electrician who actually happened to be a Brooklyn Dodgers fan. And sadly, he also was suffering from cancer, and he did not survive the year. But he lived long enough to actually listen to the Bobby Thompson home run on the radio, I'm sure to break his heart. But he was an electrician who worked at the Polo Grounds on the lights, and he was the one who set up this electrical buzzer system. And according to Prager, what they were really concerned about was when they first tried it out, the buzzer was so loud they could not help but think that the opposing team's right fielder must have heard it, but apparently he didn't.
So
yes?
They signaled it.
Well, it was one of those things where you would have, you know, as is often the case, you know, one of the players in the bullpen either stand up or sit down or cross a leg or whatever it might be, depending on what the pitch was that was coming. Right.
But one would wonder if they had time to signal that the pitcher was fairly quick in pitching.
I wouldn't know how that works. I presume it's one of those things, the catcher gives a sign, the pitcher stares in, you know, gets ready to go the line to put it set, and there is a little bit of time.
I mean, what happened?
We didn't hear the question back.
What was that?
We didn't hear the question back.
The question had to do with whether there would have been enough time, you know, for that signal. I think it would have worked basically the same way as if a runner on second base is picking off a sign. It was a question back here?
Next.
Oh. Yes?
I spoke to Ralph Franco last year. You might imagine it's very convinced that the Giants the result of and I asked him about some of the economics of it. The Giants didn't really score many more runs once they started scoring. He said, well, he knew from some talking to some players that once they got up by 5 or 6 runs, they would either stop stealing signs or they would get the information and deliberately, like, take a curveball swing to a fastball, that sort of thing. Did you uncover any evidence of that sort of thing?
Well, I got interested in this project. Okay, the question was whether there was any evidence that the Giants, to kind of keep their secret, would start deliberately missing on some pitches, you know, when in games where they wound up with the big leads. Which is interesting because the Giants really didn't have very many blowout leads, you know, blowout victories. So it's entirely possible. One of the things that struck me about this book was he never actually got to the issue of, you know, how much of an advantage was the advantage. That's what I was trying to look up. With regard to the data itself, it unfortunately doesn't tell you that. But it is kind of interesting, and one of the reasons one might conclude the advantage was marginal was that there really weren't that many blowouts or that many big innings or that sort of thing. Yes?
How would left-handers get the sign because they're in the batter's box waiting for the pitch when the sign is given to the pitcher?
I don't know, it could have been something where he would step out, or maybe the sign would have been related to the third base coach who used to be Herman Franks, but Leo DeRocher moved into the third base coach's box. The question was how left-handed batter would have gotten the sign. I have to remember to say that. Go ahead.
Chris Owens, okay. Sanchez, right field, bullpen is over, fair tournament, right field.
Yes.
Clear view with like a right center.
That's actually correct. So a left-handed batter might have still seen that. The statement was that the bullpen was way out in right field and right center field, which was way the bejesus out of there in the Polo Grounds, which is a big ballpark. Yes?
I'm interested in the ethics of this being either the Giants. And if, you know, we know the Cubs are doing it, right? Every team does it with a runner on second base. The only unique thing about the Giants situation would seem to be the buzzer.
Well, the unique thing would have been a guy with a telescope. Yeah, but that's a good possibility. You know, but you know, usually I think, you know, stealing signs by a runner on a base is sort of one thing, and everybody kind of accepts it. This is something else entirely different. And the interesting thing is that Prager insinuates that, in fact, in the World Series against the Yankees, which they lost, they did not go to Operation Sign Catcher. They may have felt maybe that it would be a little bit too conspicuous. Yes?
Yeah, there's a really good baseball prospectus book, I think they had a chapter on the season. And one of the guys who kind of wrote a confession was that their pitching was vastly improved during this whole stretch.
The question had to do with a baseball perspective article in the Pennant Race book, which is a very good book, by the way, from about 5 years ago, where the writers were saying it was pitching that did it. And I think I made the point when I said they didn't win it by cheating alone.
Any more questions?
Okay, but just quickly to finish the answer. They were seventh in the league in runs allowed on July 20th. They finished up the stingiest team in the National League. So definitely they had their pitching going for them.
One more.
Okay.
Did anyone ever, did Rocher ever actually state, or the question ever asked about this, and did he say that it was? Did anyone, I guess, is this really hard evidence, or is it just...
Everybody other than Sal Ivers, a reserve catcher who was essentially Prager's source on this, nobody ever said anything about it. Certainly not Leo. He took that secret with him to the grave, as a good spy master certainly would. But Prager makes the observation that as early as the mid-1950s, there were rumors going around that there was something fishy about that 1951 season that the Giants won.
Sal Ivers?
Yeah. Did I pronounce it wrong? Sal Ivers.
Ivers.
Ivers. My apologies to Mr. Ivers.
He did.